Disney Plus had really been the thing holding up Disney until recently, when the company said it was expecting some slowing subscriber numbers. That prompted our next guest to cut some of his estimates for the company. That is Steve Cahill over at Wells Fargo. He joins us now. Steve, how concerned are you about the subscriber growth at Disney, and what do you think it's going to mean for the overall strategy?
Thanks for having me. So certainly there is some reconsideration of the Disney Plus subscriber growth over the long term. Just as a reminder, Disney had provided long-term guidance for Disney Plus out to fiscal 24. So that gives it about 3 years. And they're about halfway there, give or take, depending on how investors decide to count the India subscribers. And a couple of weeks ago, they did announce that they were going to have a little bit slower fourth quarter. They indicated a few reasons for that, but it has caused investors to sort of reevaluate how that long-term guidance looks, what they need to do to get there. And so there's just a bit of a reset to the subscriber growth that everyone's sort of grappling with.
What's the longer term risk to Disney here? If it's subscriber growth for Disney Plus, which has been a really big selling point here for the Disney bulls, if it's slowing down, why stay long the stock?
That's exactly right. And the reason we're still bullish on it is I think what you've had now is this reassessment is that Disney Plus until now, you know, has really quickly captured the big Disney fans, you know, the kids and family genre, where they're just so impressively dominant and have a brand that is truly global. Kind of the next half of the subscribers they need to get to their target are going to come from a combination of more content on those Disney brands like Marvel and Star Wars originals, but also from more general entertainment content. And so remember, they bought Fox a couple of years ago, and that brought things like Hulu and Searchlight and FX and the Fox Television Studio. So they're going to be looking to drive a lot more general entertainment content to make parts of the genres of the service more like Hulu or HBO or Netflix and sort of fill in those other key genres. I think the reason that investors are taking a little bit of a reassessment here is because that's not where Disney has traditionally put a lot of its content. So there'll be some concerns as to whether or not they can deliver on that. Now, what makes us still bullish is that they're spending the money to do so. They have a lot of content investment ahead. And in this business, you know, not every dollar spent on content is successful. But if you got a company like Disney that knows how to make good content and they put the dollars behind it, the chances of success are pretty high.
Steve, do you think in retrospect it was a mistake to make Disney Plus and Hulu separate? I mean, as someone who is on Disney Plus pretty frequently because I have kids, you know, the content only goes so far, even though, you know, you can make as many Marvel properties as you want, but at some point you do run out.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't say it's a mistake just because it was the historical structure that, you know, Disney was only a minority shareholder in Hulu. Now they're a majority shareholder in Hulu. Comcast is a minority shareholder. My expectation is that in the not so distant future, they'll buy out Comcast's stake. And once they've done that, they'll look at integrating Hulu as a tile inside of Disney Plus domestically. But the great thing is that content is fungible. And so, you know, whether they're making a Hulu original or another original, you know, they can provide it to their subscribers across these services relatively quickly. But I think more and more you'll see Disney look to integrate its Hulu and its Disney Plus services within the next few years.
Steve, I liked your recent note out. You say the cable industry is being reevaluated by investors. And to that end, you mentioned that Discovery is a 2022 name. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so as you may recall, and thanks for reading my note, that Discovery is merging with Warner Media. They've said that that will probably close around the middle of next year. And so what often happens is when you get a large transaction, one or both of the stocks involved, they sort of just sit back for a while until the deal is set to close. You know, when the deal closes, all of the estimates will change, models will be revised, price targets will be revisited, the company will roll out its strategy. But between now and then, you just sort of get this air pocket around communication and valuation. And because the middle of next year in our modern digital world still seems like a lifetime away, I think that Discovery is one of the best via stocks for the long term, but between now and 2022, we maybe shouldn't expect the shares to have a breakout.
Steve, thanks for being here. Good to catch up with you today.
Well, as the Federal Reserve considers a path ahead for a central bank-issued digital currency, a new book is taking a look at what the future of money will look like and how CBDCs are likely to alter the way we transact. Let's bring in Ishwar Prasad. He's Cornell University professor of economics and the author of The Future of Money. We have also got our crypto reporter, David Hollerith, joining in on the conversation. Ishwar, it's great to talk to you. You know, it feels like there are so many different currencies we're talking about right now. And of course, that's more on crypto, and that's different from CBDCs. But when you look at just what that supply looks like right now, how do you think that's going to evolve in the future? And ultimately, how does that change the way we conduct financial transactions?
One thing is clear, Akiko, is that the end of physical currency, cash, is certainly drawing near. And cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin, have certainly paved the way for that revolution. Now, my own view is that cryptocurrencies may not ultimately prove to be viable mediums of exchange, especially the decentralized ones like CryptoCoin that have very volatile value and that have another number of other impediments. But they've already given rise to stable coins whose value is backed by reserves of hard currencies such as the US dollar and US dollar securities, which could provide more efficient payment transactions. And in addition, we are seeing cryptocurrencies basically catalyze central banks into issuing digital versions of their own currencies, which I think are really going to be the future of at least central bank money. These are going to lead to more efficient payment systems, bring more people into the financial system, and are going to make monetary policy effective in some ways. There are going to be some negative implications potentially for the banking system, for private sector innovations in payments, for privacy. But I think the technology is evolving to a point where some of these risks, I think, can be managed.
Yeah, and Professor Prasad, could you drill down a little bit more into the benefits and risks of central bank-backed digital currencies? I know there's a lot, which is the key benefits and risks.
So it's worth thinking, David, about why central banks are bothering to issue central bank digital currencies if private payments providers are doing the job of providing low-cost, efficient digital payments quite effectively. In many countries, the objective is financial inclusion. The idea is that if the central bank makes a very low-cost digital payment system easily accessible to everybody, including low-income people who may not have access to a credit card or a bank account, that's going to help people bring people into the financial system and also act as a portal for basic banking products and services for credit, savings, and so forth. In some other countries like Sweden, the concern is that if you have the entire payments infrastructure in the hands of the private sector, it could become vulnerable to technological or confidence problems. So the Riksbank is considering issuing an e-kroner to serve as a backstop for the private payments infrastructure. In countries like China and India, where the private sector is doing a great job of providing digital payments, the idea is to keep central bank money relevant at the retail level. So in addition to financial inclusion, you know, you can use central bank accounts, if that's the form that CBDCs take, you know, to use that as a channel for direct deposits of money from the central bank and so on. So I think there are many benefits to be had, but we will lose privacy. There could be threats to commercial banks. And in addition, you could have private payments innovations facing some difficulties if the government is doing that job.
Let's talk a little bit more about the privacy concerns, because you just laid out all of the benefits, but there's a lot of fears here that if we do move towards a CBDC here in the US, you know, do we really want the central bank knowing about every single transaction that we conduct? And you've raised that question yourself about whether, in fact, this is going to end any kind of anonymity when it comes to financial transactions. How do you think the Fed should be weighing that?
That's right, Kiko. It's a crucial issue. And the European Central Bank did a survey of its citizenry about what their primary concern about a digital currency was. It was about privacy. So if we live in a world where, in fact, every transaction that we undertake is visible, either to a private payments provider or a central bank or government agency, there is a question we need to deal with at a societal level, not just as a technocratic matter about whether that's the kind of world we want to live in. But here again, technology is providing a solution. China is moving forward with the digital currency, where there are low-grade digital wallets, as they're called, where very basic transactions, very low-value transactions, will allow users to have some degree of anonymity, while high-value transactions will require them to reveal their identity. So here, too, technology might help us to balance the benefits and risks. But I think, ultimately, no central bank wants its money to be used for illicit purposes. So auditability and traceability of transactions, and therefore loss of privacy, is, I think, a feature we're going to have to live with.
Professor, we want to take a short break here. We're not for a commercial break, but we want to take a listen to a clip that we have from President Trump, who spoke with Yahoo Finance's Adam Shapiro yesterday. Adam specifically asked Trump about the U.S. dollar, and here's what he had to say.
I think he wants to do his own currency, whether it's crypto or otherwise. And one of the reasons that we have to be very careful is we have a currency right now, the dollar. And I'm a big fan of the dollar. I'm a big fan of our currency. And I don't want to have other currencies coming out and hurting or demeaning the dollar in any way. And China's looking to do China's certainly not looking to back the dollar. But right now they're based on the dollar, and they would probably have to stay that way unless we do something very foolish in our country. I mean, the problem that I have with so much has happened, whether you look at the border, the horror show at the border, or the horror show of the Afghan withdrawal, is our country is losing credibility. And if you look at a monetary system based on the dollar, if you start losing credibility, all of a sudden you're going to lose that strong monetary system. And we have to be very careful about that.
Well, and Professor, so you heard what President Trump just had to say about that. And we've seen the central banks of the world, especially the U.S. and China, kind of jockeying the U.S. to maintain its global monetary hegemony, China to break into it years ago with SDRs or increased share in the SDR, a basket from the IMF. What is the current status here? And what do you think of Trump's comments as they pertain to this?
I'm certainly a fan of the dollar as well. Now, it seems like China is getting a jump start in terms of getting its currency, the renminbi, to become more prominent. China is one of the first major economies to undertake trials of its central bank digital currency. And it's likely that the digital yuan will be rolled out, if not nationwide, at least in most parts of the nation, sometime in the next couple of years. And there is a concern whether the U.S. Fed is asleep at the wheel. I really don't think there's a first mover advantage here. Certainly, if the digital yuan becomes widely used within and perhaps even outside the country someday, although the Central Bank of China has not indicated plans to allow that to happen, you could see the renminbi being used more for international payments to settle trade and financial transactions. But ultimately, as a store of value, as a reserve currency, it's not just economic size that matters or the depth of financial markets, but also countries' institutional framework. You know, the independent central bank, the rule of law, an institutionalized system of checks and balances. And in all these dimensions, I think China has a long way to go. So I don't worry too much that even a digital yuan is going to undercut the dollar's dominance as the global reserve currency.
Now, Professor Prasad, to Kiko's point about the loss of privacy with central bank-backed digital currencies, I've been wondering, Fed Reserve Chair Jerome Powell has talked about how, a digital dollar could potentially, it would serve the purpose that a lot of cryptocurrencies serve. And, I've heard people in the community sort of disagree with that. So I was curious, do you think the issuance of central bank-backed digital currencies or something like a digital dollar, do you think that would hurt or enhance the value of cryptocurrencies?
If the central bank were to issue a digital dollar, one can certainly see much less of a strong user case for cryptocurrencies as effective mediums of exchange. Likewise, if you think about stable coins, which many issuers are considering, including Facebook itself, which plans to issue its own stable coin called the Diem, which will be backed up by reserves of US dollar assets, those become much less important as mediums of exchange if the central bank is providing a very low-cost, efficient medium of exchange already. But cryptocurrencies also at least promise to provide some degree of anonymity, because all you need to provide are your digital identities to conduct certain transactions. But as we know, David, Bitcoin has some degree of anonymity, but not the degree of anonymity that we thought it might provide, because you can unravel users' true identities. So I think we might see a bifurcation where cryptocurrencies somewhat ironically become financial assets, although in my view, largely speculative ones. You could have a digital dollar perhaps coexisting with certain types of stable coins. And then you have some other cryptocurrencies such as Monero and Zcash, which start fulfilling the anonymity needs that certain transactors might have. So I think what we're really seeing is a bifurcation of the different roles of money into mediums of exchange, stores of value, and so forth.
You're watching Yahoo Finance Live. I'm Anjali Kimlani. Welcome to a grand discussion about everything COVID-19. We have on board with us the executive chairman of Open Orphan, Cathal Friel. Cathal, great to see you again. I know there's so much to discuss when it comes to really what's been going on with clinical trials. It's been a very interesting last year and a half, really, to just watch what's been happening with vaccines and the race. But your company has taken a really interesting approach, which is the human challenge trials. And that's something very few people are really initiated about. So let's start off with talking about why your subsidiary hVIVO is pursuing this and sort of where you stand right now.
Yeah, Anjali, pleasure to speak. It's quite interesting speaking after the president, who's worried about debt ceiling, but the damage caused by the pandemic is about 17 trillion and rising. And where we're a London Stock Exchange listed company, relatively small, but what we're helping most of the large vaccine companies in the world, and every one of them are now spending money to restock the pharmaceutical shelves of vaccines and antivirals. That's a 250 billion annualized market that will happen with immediate effect by 2025. That's the size of the vaccine market. And our company test vaccines and antivirals in a human challenge. We can do in 6 weeks, which generally takes 2 years in the field. So really exciting. The reason we made world news, the British government and ourselves were the only place in the world we actually did this with COVID-19. We deliberately, to find out, we infected a certain number of COVID volunteers who got real style wild COVID, and we were able to monitor and check in secure quarantine that we do with all our volunteers, test the efficacy and effect of COVID. And now that allows us to continue with all our other work, which is everything from influenza, RSV, RV, and HRV. There's only five or six viruses in the world that can go pandemic. The view is COVID is cured. Most people believe COVID is conquered, but the other ones are still to be conquered. And that's those. And that's what our work ahead of us.
Right. Yeah. I want to get into all the potential, but let's walk back and talk about, because the last time we spoke, you were just getting into the COVID trial. So update us on what really happened. And I understand you're waiting for the data to be published.
Absolutely. Look, the reason a lot of our company became world famous, Open Orphan, was that the British government were the first government. We had to do everything with ethics approval in the UK. That picture there is a classic one of our volunteers in a quarantine facility in London. Our history goes back to 1947. After World War II, the Allies and the British government, what killed more Allied soldiers? Was it the opposition or was it influenza? Influenza. So that's where the genesis flu camp came out of, which is part of our company. So basically, we were commissioned by the British government to take a group of volunteers. We haven't said the market number, a reasonable amount, and test what happens when we deliberately infect them in a challenge trial with COVID. That part of the project is now completed. We're waiting for the data to be published, but needless to say, it was very successful. All volunteers passed through with no major hiccup, no major issue. And there was a huge amount of learnings. We were able to examine what happens from the moment of infection. It was almost like the moment of inception. most people present with COVID when they've already been infected. So there's a ton of research now available on that. And that's basically what we do with all our other challenge study trials, where we test vaccines and antivirals across a range of infective viruses.
Right. I'm so glad you brought up antivirals, because of course we know that that's an area that has been sort of understudied throughout this pandemic. We know that, for example, Merck just announced an oral pill. Pfizer is looking at that. Do you see a role for buprenorphine there as well when it comes to treatments? Because we haven't really seen much.
Absolutely. Look, the beauty of buprenorphine, we can try anything that's infective disease. I say infectious disease is about the biggest growth market ever, the new gold rush in pharma, growing to $250 billion annually. But when it comes to those trials, the COVID one, absolutely, our challenge study can try vaccines. But really importantly, I think it's very, very clear now, the big pharma are rolling out vaccines, but they do need to test antivirals. We can see the Roche one, we know about the Pfizer one. What you need when there's vaccines working, there's always a small cohort who won't take a vaccine or where it won't work. So when those people get sick, you need the antiviral, something that'll kill the virus. A vaccine prevents it, but if you've already caught it, it's too late for the vaccine. So yes, there's absolutely, and the beauty of what we say we do, it would be very hard now to try any product for COVID in the community when it's basically under control. It was quite easy last year in mid-pandemic, downtown New York, people were dying of COVID. Today, you don't see that. So that's where human challenge, we test everything under controlled environment in secure quarantine facilities in London. We've got three of them.
Certainly. It certainly seems like there's a pathway forward for that, but we'll have to leave it there for now. Thank you again, Cathal Friel, Executive Chairman of buprenorphine, for joining us today. Look forward to speaking again soon.
Another SPAC goes live on the New York Stock Exchange today. Today it's Wallbox. They are an EV charging tech provider. And we have the CEO of Wallbox with us today, Eric Asuncion. Thank you for joining us. And tell us about your company. This is an exciting time for EV, lots of players, but maybe a little bit of consolidation as well. Tell us your company story.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here today launching our company in the New York Stock Exchange. It's a dream of me. And, you know, at Wallbox, we do two things. One is we charge electric cars, so we make a box that you put in your wall to charge your electric car. And two, we do energy management. And with energy management, we mean that we manage your energy at home, so you save money.
And Anne-Marie, when we think about the charging stations for homes, obviously, certainly something that's necessary in terms of the infrastructure in order to get to accelerate EV adoption. And yet you've got a lot of people who don't live in single family homes, who don't necessarily have access to the plug-in the way those who own these homes do. How are you thinking about the opportunity in that part of the market?
Yeah, so what's most important is that 97% of installations lie ahead, so there's a lot of growth coming, and 80% of charging happens at home. And here's where we dominate today. But of course, we also have our software and hardware solutions for semi-public locations like condominiums, companies, fleets, and also we have public charging and ultra-fast charging. So we cover the whole suite of products worldwide.
Enrique, I understand you used to work at Tesla and you started Wallbox in 2015. I'm wondering how your product compares with the Tesla Powerwall. Lots of hype around that, especially given the fact that it's Elon Musk. How does your product fit into the landscape here along with your competitors?
So the key is energy management. And when you buy an electric car, your home consumption doubles. So what we make sure is that you are not going to pay double of electricity. So we charge when energy is cheaper, because in many countries, actually in almost every country, the price of the energy changes by the hour. Two, we change when energy is renewable or when you have solar power. And three, we even have products that allow you not only to charge your car, but also discharge your car and use your EV battery as a battery for the home, which can power your home for 4 days.
Where does the technology stand right now on how quickly things can charge? I mean, we've obviously heard of these chargers, that superchargers that allow for a full charge or 80% of a charge within a 30-minute span. But, you know, some would argue that it needs to be faster than that in order to accelerate adoption. Where do you think things are going to stand a few years from now in terms of how quickly these cars can be charged through your stations or your charging
technology? So we recently announced Hypernova. It's a 350 kilowatt charger, which can charge your car in 15 minutes, which is super fast. We are going to start producing this charger in our factory in Arlington, Texas, at the second half or end of next year. So really, really excited to bring this product in the U.S.
You just mentioned your facility in Texas, slated to begin production in 2022, but you've also got manufacturing happening in places like China and Europe. What do you see as the mix moving forward? As you know, you've got an administration that is really pushing for manufacturing back at home, especially when it comes to the green economy.
Yeah, so we are seeing it everywhere, massive growth in all countries. Wallbox is present today in 80 countries in the world, so we sell in China, in Europe, and in the U.S., but we expect this year that the U.S. is going to be our biggest market in terms of sales as a country level. So we are seeing an exponential growth here in the U.S. We are actually today Amazon's bestseller and Amazon's choice. It's a small part of our sales, but it gives you an idea on how well received our products in this market.
I want to ask you one more question here before we go. We've been talking a lot about the infrastructure plan. We just heard President Biden speak about that. What are your thoughts on the rollout, some of the provisions in the infrastructure bill, as we know it, of course, hasn't been finalized yet, that would help companies like yours and the distribution and building out of the power network necessary for EVs?
So what we deliver here is the hardware and the software to the charge point operators. So we sell the technology that makes public charging reliable, fast, and affordable. And you know, we see a lot of potential with these infrastructure bills, but this is something we are seeing everywhere in the world. And actually, most of these plans are focused on selling EVs, and chargers grow faster than EVs, so it's really, really good for us. But the key here is that we provide the technology for the charge point operators, for the owner operators, and also for the people that want to charge at home or at work.
Enric Ascension, Wallbox CEO and co-founder, great to have you on today, and congratulations on the listing.
81 million Americans voted for President Joe Biden in an election that Christopher Krebs, the former director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, called, quote, the most secure in American history. Donald Trump lost the 2020 election with 74 million votes, and yet today he exerts influence, power, and control over the Republican Party and Republican members of Congress. There's a real possibility the 45th president will seek to return to the White House in 2024. Ignoring Donald Trump, as some would like us to do, will not make him or his ideas go away. Donald Trump, whether you love him or hate him, is relevant. My first question to the former president during our exclusive interview was what he thinks about the state of the U.S. economy.
Well, it looks to me like inflation is going to ravage our country. I was there a long time ago with Jimmy Carter as president, and the inflation was devastating where rates went. You had a prime rate that went up to 21%, which is not even believable when you think of it. And I saw things during that period as a businessman that I have never quite seen even since. And we've had some recessions, but not since. And it's very scary when you look at gasoline from $1.87 a gallon when I was president. It went from $1.87 and now it's well over $5, and it's going to go a lot higher. And they're calling OPEC and they're calling Russia and Saudi Arabia trying to make a deal. We had so much, we were energy independent. And,
Mr. Trump,
when you talk about inflation, sort of energy is the whole, is a big part of it, because if you make products, you have to deliver them with trucks and everything else.
So let's talk about the energy part of that, though. The energy part, I'm glad you brought up inflation, because I got the latest numbers, CPI in August, 5.3%. If you take out fuel and food, 4%. But look, Americans are paying $6.99 for a half gallon of milk. But when you talk about, for instance, fuel, the pace of inflation is actually slowing. That's what the government said. And then in California, I think, you know, the average price of a gallon of gas in California is over $4. But the rest of the country, it's like $3.50, $3.60. So it's not over $5 right now.
Well, a lot of the country, when I look at the country, I'm hearing numbers that are going to be $5 or soon to be. Don't forget, OPEC already turned down the United States. You know, they went to OPEC of all groups, and they asked for relief on getting gasoline, getting barrels of oil sent in. We had so much we didn't know. Look, we were energy independent. We had so much that we didn't know what to do with it. And now all of a sudden they're asking OPEC for help. They're asking Russia and Saudi Arabia for help. And I think that you're going to see numbers that we haven't seen in a long time for gasoline. And you really already are. You know, you were at $1.87 a gallon. And even if you take your 350 number, and that's just the low section, but a lot of the country is going to be and is already over $5. And what it's going to be in a year from now, Adam, I think is going to be much higher than that.
I want to get to some of the issues economically that we're all confronting. Okay. And I know in California, I've been corrected by my staff that it is over $5. But in a lot of the country, gas is under $5. But we have a short amount of time. And I wanted to ask you, because one of the issues that we're dealing with is this debt ceiling discussion. What worries you about whether we raise the debt ceiling or don't raise the debt ceiling? And what do you think of Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's recommendation to just do away with it?
So I think we're in trouble no matter what. If you raise it, that's not a good thing because the bill is so bad, the $3.5 trillion. And if you raise it, bad. And if you don't raise it, bad. It's a bad situation to be in. The bottom line is the $3.5 trillion plus $1.2 trillion plus other things that we had to do for COVID, et cetera, et cetera. You're talking about historic numbers. And I just don't know if this economy can take it. And if it can't take it, it's been a bad bet. So raising it is bad and not raising it is bad. I mean, you just look at what's happening and there are a lot of bad scenarios, but I think the worst scenario is $3.5 trillion. I just don't think our country can take it. And I think they're changing the norm of the country by doing it.
But help me understand what you just said, because the $3.5 trillion, that reconciliation bill that the Democrats are debating amongst themselves about how they get that through, that doesn't deal with the debt ceiling as we understand it now. The debt ceiling covers the debt that administrations, Republican and Democratic administrations, all accrued over the last several decades. So
but
why wouldn't we want to make
it,
good
Adam,
on
it? Right, but this will add to it.
It won't.
And whether if you call it an infrastructure bill, which really it's a small percentage of that money goes to infrastructure. If you talk about that one at $1.2 trillion, it all adds to it, whether it's immediately or into the future. It's tremendous borrowing. There's no way that they can take this. You know, they're saying it's net neutral. It's not net neutral. It's just the opposite of net neutral. So this will add to it, whether it's immediately or into the longer term.
Are you saying we should not raise the debt ceiling, though, and default on the debt we've already accrued? Because whether they pass any of the infrastructure, the $1.2 trillion, or the reconciliation bill, we have to raise the debt ceiling to pay for our previous debt. Are you saying we should not do that?
Well, I say this. I say that the Republicans have a very strong card to play, and they can get a lot of what they want and what they feel. You know, this was an election, and we don't have to get into it, but this was an election that was rigged, and it was very, very close at worst. It was extremely close. This was not a mandate to change the norms of our society. This was not a mandate to become a socialist country or worse. And I think the Republicans have to play the cards that they're dealt. Now, that's a very, very powerful card. It's a very strong card. Hopefully, they won't have to play it. But I think they will in order to do something with the 3.5 and other things.
Mr. President, you just said something and opened a window, so I have to respond to you about when you said the election was rigged. It was Mitch McConnell, who is, you know, the majority leader in the Senate, who said on January 6th, nothing before us proves illegality anywhere near the massive scale that would have tipped the entire election, nor can public doubt alone justify a radical break when the doubt itself was incited without any evidence. That's Mitch McConnell, Mr. President. So why do you persist with the election was rigged?
Mitch McConnell doesn't know what he was talking about. If you look at the data that's coming in from many states, you'll see that more votes than they had voters. If you look at Arizona, which, by the way, other than the coverage, the fake coverage in the press, if you look at Arizona and the findings, they had many findings. They were tens of thousands of votes, and it was a very close election. They had tens of thousands of votes that were either fraudulent or could have been fraudulent, or they didn't know.
That's not what the Cyber Ninjas found.
That alone would have turned out.
You're talking about the 74,000 votes, which actually were early votes. Those were valid votes.
No, I'm talking about much more than that. If you go to the findings in Arizona, you will see. Now, I just heard they, with a different county, they just found 35,000 additional votes. Don't forget, I lost by, so-called lost, by approximately 10,000 votes. And I heard yesterday they just found an additional 35,000 votes. So the attorney general is investigating, see, and we'll find out soon. He's looking at the whole thing. But if you look at the findings of that report done by the Senate, not done by me, it was done by the Senate of Arizona, those findings are damning. Now, Mitch McConnell doesn't know what he's talking about.
Let's get back to the economy, because Gary Cohn, an economic advisor and one of the architects of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, has joined us repeatedly. And he's pointed out on our program that a couple of promises that the tax cut would pay for itself have not delivered, and that the growth that they would generate did not deliver. How do you respond to that? What happened?
Well, I don't know what Cohn said. I can tell you this, that until COVID worked its way into our country and into the world from China, right out of probably almost certainly the Wuhan lab, until COVID came in, you had an economy that was roaring like never before. And even after we did that and went through the hell of COVID-19 or the China virus or Wuhan or whatever you want to call it, even as we worked our way and when I left office, our economy was really starting to get strong again because the foundation was so good. Had we not had COVID, then Gary Cohn would have been 100% wrong. He would have been anyway, probably.
Well,
but the COVID element is a very important thing. That came out of China, but it came out of, in a sense, you know, just from a timing standpoint, nobody ever thought this was possible to have something like this. This was in 1917, where 100 million people died. Nobody thought a thing like this was positive. And frankly, if I didn't come up with the vaccines in record-setting time, less than 9 months, and also buy a lot of the vaccine production, and you wouldn't have the shots for another 5 months from now. So,
Mr. President,
we saved tremendous numbers of lives. But
I do
the
wanna...
economy was roaring. No economy in history has ever roared.
Actually,
before.
Mr. President, on the economy, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the Bureau of Economic Analysis points out, without COVID, the first 3 years of your administration, the average growth was 2.5%, and the last 3 years of President Obama's administration was 2.3%. So, not a dramatic change.
We had the highest stock market in history. We had the most number of jobs in history. And we were getting ready to rock. We were starting to get the changes done with the horrible trade deals that were made with all of these countries. We had just made a great trade deal with China, which we actually completed, which has helped our farmers greatly. We did the USMCA. This country was ready to rock until COVID came.
When we come back after the commercial break, the second part of our exclusive interview with the former president and his message for Ron DeSantis and any other Republican who may be thinking about running for president in 2024. In part two of our exclusive interview with former President Donald Trump, I asked him about the issues that will help him determine if he's going to run for president in 2024, as well as his relationship with the very controversial Steve Bannon.
Well, I got the Pfizer, and I would have been very happy with any of them. I thought a very bad statement was when they did a pause on Johnson & Johnson. I think that frightened people. That was a bad thing to do. At that time, when they did the pause, they had six people that may have had some difficulty out of millions that received it. But I think the pause was a very bad thing to do.
Mr. President, you've talked a lot about the good state of your health, and I'm curious, would you get the booster shot?
Well, if I felt it was necessary, I guess I have sort of a double vaccine because, as you know, I had it, recovered from it pretty well. I don't think I had it like the press, like the media said. You know, they were making it difficult. Not pleasant, but I had it. I recovered. I, in addition to that, got the shot. I mean, I'm somebody that tells people I'd like to see them get it. I also want them to have their freedoms, et cetera. But I got the double shot. And if I felt that it was necessary, and let's see where this whole thing is going. I mean, I was surprised. I thought it would have been gone long before now. You know, you don't hear Biden being criticized for the fact that this thing is lingering on in some cases, you know, numbers that are very, very large.
It is, Mr. President, it is lingering on. But when I mentioned you had said to your supporters, get a vaccine, some of them booed. And the current data shows us that it's the unvaccinated that are contributing to why it's lingering. What do you say to those people?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I was president, everybody wanted to get the vaccine. Everybody. There was a rush to get it. You didn't hear anything about mandates. You didn't hear anything about, oh, gee, people don't want to take it. After I left, people don't want to take it. And it's very interesting. And I think it's because they don't trust Biden. They don't trust the administration. As you know,
you don't think it's misinformation about the vaccines?
Vice President Harris made some very nasty comments. And I think maybe people took that seriously, what she said. But, you know, I think they hurt the vaccine. Now they're trying to get everybody to take it. But I will say, and I think you'll agree, when I was president, there was a rush to get it. Everybody wanted to get it. It was only after that you started to hear this.
Let's shift to the political landscape, because we're all curious. What issues are you considering that will help you decide if you're going to run for the Republican nomination to become president in 2024?
Okay. Well, when I looked at what happened with the military in Afghanistan, that was a horrible, horrible situation. Taking the military out first began it, but it was just grossly incompetent. We lost the 13 young, incredible warriors. We also have many wounded that nobody talked about, but very seriously wounded. I guess 200 and close to 250 people died, okay, of the people in the area. 250 people died almost, and it was terrible. Leaving behind $85 billion worth of the finest military equipment in the world instead of taking it out. Every single screw, bolt, every machine, every plane, every tank was going to be taken out under my. The tents were going to be taken out. The big hangars that you see. They were going to be
taken
out.
Does your administration bear any responsibility? I mean, it was the negotiation under your administration that precipitated our withdrawal. Are you saying you would have left soldiers, you would have left the U.S. military in Afghanistan because you were in favor of pulling everyone out?
No, we have absolutely no responsibility. I dealt with Abdul, who's the leader, and I told him very strongly that you will be hit harder than any country has ever been hit. And he understood that. And as you know, and Biden even admitted it, for 18 months, not one soldier was shot at or killed. Not one soldier, not one American. And I let them know, you can't do that. That was a part of the agreement. If they didn't fulfill conditions, if you know, we had 2,500 people there. We started with close to 20,000, and we were down to 2,500. And I was a big proponent of getting out. But getting out with dignity, getting out with no death. There would not have been. We had them exactly where we wanted to have them, and they would not have done anything to us. We would have been able to take our soldiers out, take our equipment out, but we would have taken the soldiers out last. First, all of the Americans come out, and people that deserve to come out beyond the Americans. We've taken out hundreds of thousands of people that most of them, only 3%, at this moment, seem to deserve to come out. We don't even know who these people are.
So Mr. Trump, when you consider what it's going to take for you to decide if you're going to run for president, this would be one of the issues. Curious, though.
This would be one. Just the gross incompetency.
One of many issues, I would imagine. But you'd have to win the nomination again.
Well, the economy.
I'm curious, how would you...
I mean, I'll give you a couple of others. Well, the economy, inflation.
But if you faced a Republican like Ron DeSantis in the primaries, what would it take for you to beat him?
Well, number one, I don't think I will face him. because I don't see that. If I did it, I don't see that. I think most people would drop out. I think he would drop out. And if I faced him, I'd beat him like I would beat everyone else, frankly. And you take a look at what's going on in the polls, where I have way over 90%, and in some cases 98% approval rating in the Republican Party, because I did a great job as president, despite all of the hoaxes, despite the Russia stuff that now has been exposed as a total fraud. Despite everything, we did a great job. Largest tax cuts in history, rebuilt the military, Space Force, took care of our vets. 92% approval rating in the VA for the first time ever, way higher than ever before. You know, we did a job that nobody's done. And had COVID not come and interrupted, we had the greatest economy. Again, say what you want. We had 160 million jobs. Our country was never close to that.
Mr. Trump, it's not what I want. It's just the jobs created during your administration. I think that it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics points out it was something like 6.4 million jobs. And during the Obama administration, it was 7 million jobs. But when I hear what you're saying about the need for perhaps you to run in 2024, what I'm hearing you say is you are going to run. Are you?
No, I haven't said that. I said that if I do run, I think that I'll do extremely well. And I'm looking not only at polls, I'm looking at the enthusiasm. We did a great job. Now, when you say what you had just said, the economy, as you know, was very bad when he took over. So the economy wasn't terrible when I took over, but it wasn't great. It was stagnant and slow. I guess it was the worst recovery since the Depression of 1930. So that's not a very good job done by the previous administration. But I took over an economy and I made it into 160 million jobs. And it was really getting ready to rock. We would have rocked it. But then, as you know, COVID came in from China.
You bring up China. A great many of our viewers here on the Yahoo Finance platform are into cryptocurrencies. And the well-known Bitcoin investor, Anthony Pompliano, was just on my program talking about China's crackdown on crypto. He says that's a big gain for the United States. You have a relationship with the Chinese president, Xi Jinping. What do you think Xi Jinping is up to? And is this crackdown on crypto good for the U.S.?
Well, I think he wants to do his own currency, whether it's crypto or otherwise. And one of the reasons that we have to be very careful is we have a currency right now, the dollar. And I'm a big fan of the dollar. I'm a big fan of our currency. And I don't want to have other currencies coming out and hurting or demeaning the dollar in any way. And China's looking to do, China's certainly not looking to back the dollar, but right now they're based on the dollar and they would probably have to stay that way unless we do something very foolish in our country. I mean, the problem that I have with so much has happened, whether you look at the border, the horror show at the border, or the horror show of the Afghan withdrawal, is our country is losing credibility. And if you look at a monetary system based on the dollar, if you start losing credibility, all of a sudden you're going to lose that strong monetary system. And we have to be very careful about that.
Mr. Trump, there's one last question I want to ask you as we wrap. And it's because I covered your administration for the first year and a half. I was in Washington. And I remember that Steve Bannon lost your trust when he spoke to Michael Wolff for that book. And he left the administration. But he's re-earned your trust. And I'm curious what he did to get back into your good graces and to get your trust?
Well, Steve didn't get along with certain people in the administration, so I understand that that happens, and it happens with all administrations, frankly. And for a period of time, he didn't do it, and I understand that. But if you look at Steve over the last 3 years, he sees what a great job we've done as an administration. When you look at all of the things that I've enumerated, plus many others, I mean, a thing like Right to Try, where you can get medical treatment of something experimental if you're in a bad shape.
But Mr. Bannon, advising you towards the end of your administration?
Excuse me?
Mr. Bannon was advising you towards the end of the administration?
No, not at all. No, I haven't spoken to Steve almost at all. No, he wasn't. But I know that he's got a show that's very successful.
So is he lying when he says he was talking to you in the last months of your administration?
Very little. We would speak very little. Now, Steve and I spoke very little, but I will tell you he was very supportive on his show, which is a successful show, and he was very supportive in the media. as to the things. But no, we spoke very little, actually. But he was extremely supportive.
Donald Trump, the 45th president of the United States, thank you so much for joining us on Yahoo
Finance.
Thank
you very much, Adam.